You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Into this place of peace, and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory, and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power, and let its vision change your heart. Good evening and welcome, everyone. Welcome to this, our June, our first winter Shady Grove service, and it's a lovely, cold, clear winter's day, which is, I think, the best sort of winter's day, except at 6 o'clock in the morning. Those who are unlucky enough to have to get up at that time. But it has been a beautiful day, and I hope you've all had a lovely day.
Now, that's a candle of sadness and the memory of my former colleague and friend, Beck Agard, who last week, for reasons I can't begin to contemplate, took her own life and that of her 9-year-old son. Very sad.
She was a lovely person.
I just mentioned Manchester, and of course there's a concert, I think, tonight in Manchester, and I hope that goes well. I'm sure it will still go ahead, and I hope it's a joyous occasion for all who take part. This reading, just by chance, is set in Manchester. It's from a story called Wrestling and Resting, Exploring Stories of Spirituality in Britain and Ireland. The author of the reading is Niall Cooper. Niall was the National Coordinator of Church Action on Poverty in the UK, and he lives and works in Manchester in the north of England. Niall's piece is titled Bus Stop Spirituality. I am an urban dweller, a city dweller in fact. Perhaps that's why I have great difficulty getting my head around the idea of spirituality. Spirituality conjures up for me images of monasticism, contemplation, distant holy isles and quiet mountain pastures, losing oneself in the great spiritual traditions or mystics of the past, be they Celtic or Franciscan. Earnestly seeking for my heart to be strangely warmed, etc. I know they are terrible cliches, but they are, after all, the kind of rustic images of religiosity with which I have been infused since childhood. All things bright and beautiful, and all of that. I've tried that kind of spirituality, and it didn't work. As an earnest 20-year-old, I set off on a spiritual journey which ended up in the green pastures of rural France and a week's silent retreat at Taizé. I listened awfully hard for that still, small voice to speak to me, believe me, only it didn't. So I packed my bags and headed for the city, Manchester to be precise, and I've struggled with what spirituality means ever since. The trouble is, living in the city, that still, small voice is drowned out by the noise of buses, the aircraft, my 3 children, 3 months, 2 years and 4 years, the next door neighbour's teenagers, the crowd at Old Trafford when they score a goal, and most of all the constant background noise of my own mind telling me what needs to be done next. First century Jerusalem didn't suffer from noise pollution, information overload, or the curse of trying to be a thrusting, constantly changing, 24-hour global metropolis. Modern cities just aren't places to be spiritual in the old time sense. My 15 years in Manchester have all been spent living in or within a mile or so in either direction of Hume, an estate not a stone's throw from the city centre, and an archetype of the modern city. Hume, one of Manchester's and the world's first working-class neighbourhoods, didn't exist 150 years ago. It was green fields, and I'm sure it was a very spiritual place. In the last 50 years, it has been completely transformed, redeveloped, razed to the ground, not once, but twice. Maps are supposed to be very good at helping you locate where you are, at giving you a sense of place and a sense of direction, which is one way of looking at spirituality. In Hume, the problem is that any map that is more than 2 years old will serve only to get you lost and confused. The flat in which I spent 5 happy years being exposed to the realities of inner city living and cut my teeth as a community worker is now an empty plot of waste ground. It's difficult to put your mind to getting in tune with the spiritual essence of centuries yore when your own recent past is now ancient history. So where do I, city dweller, busy national coordinator, husband and parent of three, find spiritual solace in 21st century Manchester? This is where I'll let you into a little secret. I think I've found a place of spiritual significance, even in the midst of the city, which may yet become a shrine and a place of pilgrimage for people all over the world at the end of the 21st century. It's the number 86 bus stop on the corner of Moss Lane East and Chichester Road on the border of Hume and Moss Side. I used to cycle past it regularly on my way to work, fast and furious, late and in a rush, with my mind full of the 15 things I had to do that day. Sometimes now I catch the bus further up the road and can look down on the bus stop from the top deck of the bus. Sometimes the bus stop is empty. But more often than not, there are 2 or 3 people gathered at it, waiting for the bus, as you might expect. I used to ignore it entirely, but then, one day, it occurred to me, what if one of those people waiting at the number 86 bus stop, possibly, just possibly, might be Jesus? I wouldn't know, of course, and since I've had that thought, I've never stopped at the bus stop to check. But somehow, in some obscure way, I'm strangely warmed by the thought that in the hurdy-burdy of the city, of the myriad of happenings that I never get to see, and the myriad of people that I never get to know, God is waiting, along with the rest of us, for the number 86 bus. Let us now join together in the spirit of prayer, meditation, and contemplation. Let us be still. Words tell us of our thoughts. Silence helps us hear our deeper feelings. In silence, we sense the rhythmic measure of all life in the slow, repetitive rhythm of our own bodies. In silence, we sense a larger spiritual presence of which we are all a part. In silence, we sense the coming and going of human pathways, knowing we can ask no more than to have to reach out to others in creative and caring ways. And in this silence, we know it is this human touch that gives the larger journey its meaning. I'd like to open this evening's address by describing the plot and the theme of one of my favourite films. The film is titled Smoke. Has anyone here seen it? It was written by the New York novelist, screenwriter and broadcaster Paul Auster. In the film, Augie Wren, who is played by the veteran actor Harvey Keitel, manages a cigar shop on the corner of 3rd Street and 7th Avenue in Brooklyn, New York City. Every morning at exactly 8 o'clock, no matter what the weather, he takes a picture of the shop from across the street. He has 4,000 consecutive daily photographs of his corner, all labelled by date and all mounted in albums. He calls his project his life's work. One day, Augie shows the photos to Paul, a blocked writer who is mourning the death of his wife, a victim of random street violence. Paul doesn't know what to say about the photos. He admits he has never seen anything like them. Flipping page after page of the albums, he observes with some amazement. They're all the same. Augie watches him and then replies, "You'll never get it if you don't slow down, my friend." The pictures are all at the same spot, Augie points out, but each one is different from every other one. The differences are in the details, in the way people's clothes change according to season and weather, in the way the light hits the street. Some days the corner is almost empty. Other times it's filled with people, bikes, cars and trucks. It's just one little part of the world, but things take place there too, just like everywhere else, Augie explains. And sure enough, when Paul looks carefully at the by now remarkably unique photographs, he notices a detail in one of them that makes all the difference in the world to him. Augie is a model of a spiritually literate person. He reads the world, in his case, one corner in Brooklyn, New York City, for meaning. By its very nature, his project is rooted in the everyday. He knows how closely we may need to look to see the significance of seemingly ordinary and insignificant events. He understands that some of the most rewarding spiritual journeys are those that we take on our own block. Like any good film or book or painting or piece of music, that film Smoke has lived on in me ever since I saw it, probably over 20 years ago now, and I think about its messages often. The entire film revolves around Augie's cigar shop and the people who come into it, and the fascinating and touching friendships that develop in that shop. Sometimes people come into the shop to buy things, but very often they come in just to chat, to share a coffee or sometimes a cigar with Augie and the other customers. It's quite a pokey little shop, really, but in there, lives are really changed. Sometimes they are changed in one dramatic encounter in the shop, but more often than not, they are changed in gradual and subtle ways. This change is so subtle and so gradual, in fact, that those changed just cannot quite work out why they feel so much better about themselves and life in general, and why some almost compulsive urge and force keeps putting them into Augie's shop, when they have absolutely no intention of buying cigars or other smoking paraphernalia. The central attraction of the shop initially is Augie himself, although his attraction too seems almost invisible or unconscious. People are attracted to him like bees to a honeypot. He has some sort of charismatic pull, but it is not charisma of a flamboyant style. He does not dazzle people with his knowledge or humour. He does not keep them enthralled with enchanting or exotic stories, nor does he mesmerise them with a sharp wit. Rather, it is his quiet, accepting presence that pulls people to him and his shop. In that shop, Augie creates a place where people feel accepted, where they do not feel judged. The cigar shop becomes a place where people can bring their bruised and reticent selves to meet with other bruised and reticent selves. A place where, through the quiet, non-judgmental and gentle atmosphere of the place, people can be most be themselves, in this informal and most unlikely of places. People can be more the selves they were supposed to be, more than they are able to be in their more obvious and formal settings of their lives. In their families, in their trades and professions, their sports clubs, their therapist's office, or in their church communities. Although the attraction of the cigar shop is initially Augie himself, he has created an atmosphere where the attraction slowly becomes the shop itself and all the other customers that gather in there. Somehow the cigar shop has become a place of soul. It was a brilliant idea, I thought, by Paul Auster, this film's scriptwriter, to paint a picture of a place of depth and soul developing in a dark, pokey cigar shop, an outlet selling tobacco, a place normally associated with the peddling of tools of ill health, seediness, and death. Such is the nature of paradox, a subtle reminder that things below the surface are often far more than they seem at face value, and that compassion, mercy, love, and care come in the most unlikely of places. The atmosphere in that cigar shop in the film Smoke was the kind of atmospheres that most families dream about trying to create. The educational experts spend years of research and pots of money trying to implement. The community leaders in a variety of sectors devote hours and hours of workshop time to. And that ministers of religion spend many long dark nights of the soul contemplating. Of course, you could say, well, it is just a film. Places like that do not really exist, and experiences like that do not really happen. Well, I'd not be so sure. Since becoming a minister 19 years ago, I've tried to stop and listen and take notice of all the places that my chaplaincy colleagues, members of my congregations, and friends and family tell about that might resemble the soulfulness of Augie's cigar shop. And I've taken note of all the places that I have encountered that feed my soul in such a way. When I first arrived in Richmond, in London, in 2001 to commence my first ministry, a member of my congregation named Amy told me of such a place. Amy was in her late 80s. She lived alone and had considerable speech and mobility difficulties. She told me about a hardware shop in Isleworth, where we both lived, just around the corner from my house. It was a good place to go, she said, for almost anything. It was just called Mr. Taylor's shop. The shop owner, who I think was called Mr. Taylor, I'm not sure, was very helpful. When Amy had trouble with her answer phone, she took it into his hardware shop and he fixed it. He explained to her very patiently how it worked and wouldn't dream of paying for any of this service. For the first time I went in there, I was struck by how much laughter there was and how the shop was always full of people chatting and laughing. And I very rapidly became hooked. I went in there every week, and I continued to go in there every week for the 6 years I lived there. I went in to buy anything, really. And if I didn't need something, I would invent a reason that I would need some gadget or other. And our house is still uselessly full of things that came from Mr. Taylor's shop. I would go in there for a chat and to laugh, and I always came out feeling better than I did before I went in. And that is despite Mr. Taylor teasing me mercilessly about being a minister and saying that I had to be considered insane. Why on earth would anyone want to do that job? Likewise, over the years, it was my privilege to come across a gathering of retired men, all of differing backgrounds, who met each day along the banks of the River Thames near my house in London to go fishing. I saw them on my daily walks along the river, sometimes walking my dog Buster, sometimes walking in hope of inspiration for Sunday morning sermon, and sometimes during my maternity leave breaks, pushing Imogen and Maisie along in their prams. And I met these fishermen. They numbered between 6 and 8. They were, as I said, all retired, and they were all widowers. They arrived each morning around 10 a.m. They brought with them their folding chairs, their umbrellas if it was raining, and beach shades when it was hot. They brought their picnic hampers with sandwiches and cakes, their thermos with hot tea, their fishing rods, and all their fishing paraphernalia. They were always accompanied by one or more scruffy-looking dogs. I often stopped and chatted to them, and over the years I seemed to acquire some sort of honorary status amongst them. They chatted about all sorts of things. I heard them chat about religion, politics, marriage, divorce, widowhood, and loneliness being amongst them. And of course, the more prosaic things of life, and about fishing, of course. It was truly touching when one of them lost a very much loved old dog. The others comforted him in his distress, and then they reassured him afterwards about his embarrassment at that distress. They did many things for each other, this unlikely bunch, but one thing I never ever saw them do was catch a fish. Not one in 6 years. It seems we have an innate need for these informal places of meeting and sharing. They don't take the place of our more formal associations, our families, our workplaces, Our sports clubs and hobby groups, our counsellors and doctors, and our church communities. They instead augment all these groups and associations and add to our emotional and spiritual repertoire. The North American sociologist Ray Oldenburg has spent his lifetime researching such informal associations and their benefits. He has written about his findings in a lovely book titled The Great Good Place: Cafes, coffee shops, bookstores, bars, hair salons, and other hangouts at the heart of community. In the book's introduction, he explains his lifelong interest in such places. He says, "My interest in these happy gathering places that a community may contain, these homes away from home, where unrelated people relate, is almost as old as I am. Children, I suspect, are instinctively attuned to the climate of human relations around them, and experience an inner joy and serenity, a feeling that all is well when the adults in their lives relax and laugh in each other's company." That, at least, was my reaction. Perhaps it was that winter evening during my fifth year when the older cousins took me along to our town skating rink and deposited me amid the joyful and animated little crowd in its warming shack that I first drank the joys of blissful public congregation, and I have never since lost my appetite for it. Ray Oldenburg has studied such places as barber shops in Turkey, sidewalk cafes in France, beer halls in Germany, coffee houses in Vienna, pubs in England and Ireland, and soda streams and lunch counters in the Midwest of North America, as well as grocery shops, hairdressers, playgrounds, and park benches the world over. He refers to these places when they work, that is, when they provide for us that elusive, soulful quality that we all find so hard to define, but know in an instant when we experience it, as third places. First places, he says, are our families, both nuclear and extended. Second places are our places of formal affiliation, our workplace, the sports club, our church communities, the photography club, the amateur dramatic society, our physiotherapist's rooms, and our counsellor's office. The third place, by contrast, is informal. The value of such places is subtle and understated. However, they are as vital to our emotional and spiritual development as all our more formal associations and commitments, and we overlook them at our peril. There are some things that these third places can do for us that Ray Oldenburg says our first and second places just cannot do for us, or not nearly as well as a third place can. These third places, these informal public meeting places, are great levelers, he says, and they can more than any other experience expand our horizons, our associations, our minds, and ourselves generally. Third places, park benches, bus stops, hardware shops, barber shops, the playground, places where children and parents meet, do not select criteria for membership or exclusion, and conventional status counts for little in these places. As hard as we all might try to make our formal associations diverse and inclusive, all of us tend to select friends and associates from among those closest to us in social rank. And we tend to mix with people who are like us, who have backgrounds like us, who live like us, and who like the same things and have the same interests as us. As valuable as such mutual associations are, over time they can insidiously narrow, restrict, and confine us. The informality and egalitarianism of third places can, by contrast, expand us. They can open us up to new people, new experiences, and new possibilities. They can liberate us from the roles that our more formal associations demand of us. I'm endlessly fascinated and at the same time humbled whenever I hear of the richness and depth of such places and the roles they play in people's lives. When I walk alongside the River Angus in what I still consider my new hometown, Strathalbyn, I notice how many of these third places are around. Park benches where people gather, market sheds, bus stops, and groups of people chatting inside and outside all the local shops. These are similar to the third places I encountered on the other side of the world as I walked my dog along the River Thames in London each day. As I walked along the path, I always read the memorial inscriptions on the park benches that lined the path. They were testament to the importance of place in our lives, of the importance of these third places, these great good places in our lives. Peter Fraser Cole, CBE, a Scotsman and a Londoner who loved the river, said one. John Young, it was a wonderful journey with thanks to old Father Thames, said another. Many members of my former congregation had such a connection with Kew Gardens. Some of them had lived alongside this beautiful place of botany and history and joy all their lives. It had been a place of refuge for them on weekends, when they spent their working lives amongst the noise and concrete of inner London. And in a retirement, it had been a place for them to discover unexplored talents and passions, where they worked for many years as volunteers in the garden. And then, in their 80s and 90s, they still managed to visit the gardens weekly. One lady who lived alone sat in Kew Gardens each week reading and writing letters. She once said to me that during that time in the garden, she felt her loneliness, chronic pain from arthritis, and her worry over financial difficulties disappear. The gardens were, for her, a sacred place. Much, much closer to me now, in time and place, is my place of work, Sash Ferguson Aged Care Nursing Home in Mount Barker. We at Sash Ferguson are undergoing a large-scale renovation and refurbishment project. It has been a real challenge. We have, amongst our 54 residents, their families, our staff and volunteers, another whole army of people. Painters, builders, electricians, carpet layers, plumbers, project managers in high visibility vests who are there every day, and corporate project managers who come in fancy suits once a week and tell the high visibility vest managers what to do next. There are orange witches' hats and yellow tape cordoning off areas. We have ladders and drop cloths, paintbrushes and paint, hammers and drills. Every day I have someone new in my office who is just perching there while their office is being redone. And our reception area has changed 3 times. Amongst this, we have the residents, whose home this chaos is, negotiating their way around this all in wheelchairs, on gophers, with walking frames and walking sticks, some with very low vision and impaired hearing, and many very, very confused with dementia, as they negotiate a world of ladders, drills, and witch's hat. It has been very challenging, and our residents have been incredibly tolerant and resilient, even though many have been quite alarmed, disoriented, and confused by this whole process. Despite the inconvenience and disruption this has caused us all, and even though we are all very much looking forward to getting back to normal, this renovation process has revealed some unexpected benefits. Each morning, the residents have been required to come out of their rooms straight after they have breakfast and are showered and dressed. They cannot return until after their evening meal. While they are gone, painters, plumbers, carpet layers and electricians do their job. Before we undertook the renovations, organised activities such as quoits and skittles, bingos, concerts, newspaper reading, arts and crafts were held. Residents were strongly encouraged to attend, but it was not compulsory. Some residents loved these activities. Others couldn't think of anything worse, and politely, or not so politely, declined all invitations to do so. The mornings were always free, and most people stayed in their rooms. While we've been undergoing renovations, though, we've arranged makeshift seating all around the nursing home. Most seats face out of the window where people can catch the sunshine and look at the view. Other seating, though, has been placed in corridors and corners, wherever we can find a space. What we have noticed is that people who would normally have stayed in their room for weeks on end and who dislike organised group activities have really enjoyed coming out and sitting on a seat, looking out of the window at the view, and having a chat to whoever sits down next to them. Some people have made new friends and look forward to seeing them each day. Others just welcome a casual chat to whoever comes along each day. I've noticed some animated conversations with lots of laughter. Other pairs or groups of people appear to just enjoy a companionable silence. It's been a real education to us all. We have had good first places at our nursing home. Lovely, homely, private and quiet rooms that our residents retreat to when they wish to. And we have some really stimulating and fun second places, our shared meals, our bus trips and our games and concerts. What we need to take more seriously, I think, is the nurturing of those third places. Groups of seats in corridors, sunrooms, chairs on the verandas and garden benches. Places where small groups of people can feel safe and welcome, and where conversation can develop naturally without plan or expectation. As we move through the rich and complex story that is our lives, may we not dismiss such places as trivial and inconsequential. As we negotiate the maze of human experience, let us know that mercy and compassion can be dispensed in a cigar shop, at the playground or the bus stop, and on the veranda of a nursing home, as well as at church and within our families. The horizons can be broadened in a conversation at the hairdresser's and at the hardware store, as well as at work, school and university. The understanding, insight and wisdom can be gained on the train to work and walking through the park, and that friends can be made walking the dog and taking the children to the playground, as well as all the formal places we normally associate with such experiences. May we all stop to notice the orgies amongst us, and may we recognise our own cigar shop and number 86 bus stop experiences for what they are, yet another opportunity to discover the sacred in our midst. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.